In the studio this morning, I have Colin Bearden of Waiheke Island. Colin previously worked in computer multimedia and was a research professor at Waikato University. At present, Colin is involved in local body politics and especially to bring to the public consciousness of Waiheke the idea of the whole island becoming a biosphere reserve. So, kia ora and good morning, Colin.
Kia ora.
Colin, could you just open it up? What is a biosphere so that we can get a handle on that?
Well, a biosphere reserve is where people and the environment are going to work together to support each other. That's the main idea.
Our planet is a biosphere. All life from, say, 150, 200 metres below the surface of the ground all the way up to 200 kilometres within the biosphere, that's where all life between animals and humans and plants all work. And, of course, there's also Biosphere 2, which was in Tucson, Arizona, where they took 2.5 acres and they sealed it all off with glass in a very profound architecture and put humans in there to see if they could survive for a couple of years, thinking that they may be able to put this particular system on Mars or the Moon. So when we have this biosphere on Waiheke, what you're wanting to do is make it that people can live healthily and fully, and the environment works well too. Could you explain what this is on Waiheke?
I think you could take it from perhaps more the history of what people have tried to do to preserve their environment in the past. And often what they've done is to try to set aside an area and almost kind of keep it exactly as it was without changing. And that might be okay for certain particularly important places and sites, but it doesn't really affect the rest of the planet. So what the biosphere reserves are about is taking an area that's very special in some way, and lots of areas are special, and looking at how human activity affects those areas. Now, that might be because you've got a big city nearby and it's just spreading out towards them. It might be because you've got tourists coming because it's a particularly beautiful place. It might be you've got an industry downstream that's putting stuff into the water. Or it might be the whole global climate change. All of these things can affect areas that are special to us. And so the Biosphere Reserve is really looking at that interaction and trying to improve it.
Why Waiheke Island?
Well, in some ways it's much easier in an island, because you put a bit around it, and if you want to monitor it, because the biosphere reserves are a kind of a scientific experiment as well, in that you try and improve something in your environment, and you should be able to measure that. You should be able to say, well, at the end of 3 years, we tried really hard, and we did succeed, or we only succeeded a little bit, or we succeeded a lot. And so islands are particularly good for doing that, because you've got a fixed number of people, you've got a fixed boundary, you know that the effect of the next bit of land isn't going to kind of skew your results. So that's one reason. I mean, the other reason, which is the much more the human one, which is a very strong community, and it's got a very strong identity as a community. And I think that's probably the major reason why I would pick Waiheke, because it feels threatened by, in some extent, by Auckland. It sees some opportunities from the big city of Auckland, and that's very much the current kind of debate that's going on Waiheke, is about trying to preserve those community, all the strengths of the community and the strengths of the environment within something like the super city, you know.
Because Waiheke is a fairly dynamic. There's so many diverse groups of people, and of course it's a very beautiful place, and they want to keep it that way. And as you said, they don't want to be swamped by Auckland super city coming in and putting freeways through it.
I mean, who does? Who does? But I think Waiheke in particular is very aware that it could lose a lot. Like, the idea came around in a way because I opened this thing one day at the World Commission. We're going to be talking about the super city, okay? And they said, we want to make Auckland a world-class city, okay? And I walked down the road, and there's a lookout at the end of my road, and there were some visitors from South Island, and they stood there and they said, this has got to be the most beautiful spot in the world. And I kind of put those two ideas together. Here's a whole, you know, millions of dollars being spent already on trying to make us a world-class city, and yet these people were standing there saying this is world-class now, and that needs to be protected and preserved. And I think that somehow in all our thinking about the super city, we're going down the wrong direction in thinking that we've got to build a super city rather than just learn to live in harmony with what we've already got.
because you also have the support in many ways. It's called a UNESCO Biosphere Reserve. Can you explain a little bit more about that aspect?
Yeah, well, UNESCO is an organisation within the United Nations. It was set up just after the war, and it does all kinds of work in educational, cultural, minority groups and languages, and has a whole scientific programme, and this would come under its scientific programme. What would happen is that we would apply, and we would just basically describe Waiheke as it is now, particularly the natural environment, but also all the projects that are going to improve and regenerate the island back to perhaps what it was 150 years ago. If UNESCO accept that, they say, yes, you can call yourself a biosphere reserve. And it's a bit like, I guess, a farmer who might be operating organically wants to get that official seal of being an organic farm, because then you can use that and you can start to organise, and you get visitors who come to you on that basis. You can perhaps trade your products, and the produce has a kind of added value because it comes from a environmentally sound process and so on. So UNESCO doesn't play a very strong role in it. They coordinate you with other reserves around the world, and I think that's the other interesting aspect. But Waiheke would be joining this club with 560 or 70 other members, all of whom in their own situations, which are very, very different from Waiheke's, but they're trying to do the same thing for themselves.
Something like, what, 109 countries involved?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And New Zealand hasn't got one?
No. No.
But Australia has.
Yes.
And New Zealand's supposed to be a clean and green country? We want to be a world leader in conservation and the natural world? What's happening? Why are we so slow?
I think there's two reasons, really. There's a kind of cultural reason, that this idea that we don't need to do it, that we're kind of, we've got so many natural advantages that we don't need to learn from the rest of the world. We're okay. And I think that argument may have applied 20 years ago. But with the way that New Zealand has gone, we have some of the most polluted rivers in the world now. It isn't clean, green anymore. It just happens to have not too many people in it. But as time goes on, the problems of pollution are getting great. The Hauraki Gulf is suffering. The water is beginning to suffer from some of the flow off from effluent with farms that are right up in the Waikato. And they're now coming down and flowing into the Gulf and affecting the Gulf. So the idea that New Zealand kind of just does it better and we don't need to look at other examples, we don't need to do that, I don't think that stacks up much more. So there's that reason. There's a lot of things going on with DOC, and DOC is under a lot of pressure. The Department of Conservation is under a lot of pressure. And I think there's a lot of things that they would like to do, and they're actually getting reduced budgets. And so there's a kind of bit of a political issue there about, do we want to be going into new areas when, in fact, we're losing money, the government's cutting our budget all the time.
So if you could get the whole population of Waiheke to say, hey, we are an entity, that we're not independent, we're interdependent with the Auckland mainland, for want of a better word, and we can work together, but we have our own autonomy to a degree that we want to make sure that we take care of the whole natural kingdom.
Absolutely. I mean, in a sense, you see, as I said, it's a response to the super city, and it's not a negative response at all. It's saying, okay, if Auckland wants to be a world-class city, well, Waiheke has already got world-class status. Now, if we look after that and we develop it in the right way and present it in the right way, we're actually helping Auckland to make that a reality. And people will visit, but they won't visit just because they're basically looking for shopping or, you know, the wrong kind of reasons. They will come to Waiheke because they understand what it's about and they want to learn about what we do there. And so that kind of cultural identity that comes through working with the land will be the reason that people come to visit us, rather than some dream that an advertising person has perhaps made up, you know.
Well, in many ways, when you're in Queensland, you go and see the Great Barrier Reef. Why? Because it's teeming with life, and it's precious. And we go to Waiheke, not that Waihekeans are precious, but or teeming with life, but they're teeming with vitality. But it's something to be proud of. Oh, go to Waiheke, the Biosphere Reserve. Oh, you can dip yourself and submerge your vehicle in the water and see that the water is actually clean, even though it could be deteriorating. That there are stands of bush, native bush there, stony batter on a clear blue sky day, it's magnificent.
Yeah, I mean, you get these moments on Waiheke, and a visitor or a resident or not, you just go along and you look out across a bay that's sparkling in the winter sunshine and boats and headlands, and it's just great to be alive. You just stand there and think, it's great to be alive. Those moments are so important to people, particularly people who live perhaps busy lives and so on as well as others. And it's so easy to take those things for granted, isn't it? It's so easy to, and then the super cities talking about, well, opening up easier to do business. And you think, well, one day there could be an aqua farm here, or there could be a big commercial tourist development or something, and that would be lost. That would be lost forever then. And we just don't want that to happen. We know what's valuable, and it doesn't need that. It needs to be kept as it is.
Waiheke is a cohesive society, a microcosm, really, of the greater New Zealand way. There's so many different groups. Can you explain to the listeners, or tell us about a few of the different divergent groups that are working to benefit Waiheke?
I'm surprised just in the Biosphere Reserve, the kind of people that have come forward to support it from all sections of the society. I mean, a lot of people who run just small accommodation, for example, they'll put a couple overnight or two or three couples they've got rooms for. They're strongly supportive of it. Kayakers, boaters are very strong because they're very well at the environment that goes on there and so on. All the people in the arts do because they love to have an audience, and it's great if people come and learn and stay. And a lot of local producers are people who grow honey and lavender and produce soap and whatever. They like it. And the Marae is strongly supporting it. People from the churches are supporting it. All the environmental groups are supporting it. It's got a very wide backing from people coming from all kinds of directions. It's not like it's just the Greenies doing it. It's a much broader thing than that. And that's very interesting because it's kind of united people around the idea that perhaps we can empower ourselves a little bit. We can stand up for what Waiheke is and what we all feel it represents. And that cuts right across all the normal divisions in society that might occur if it's seen to be a very political issue one way or the other. And it's about standing up for what's positive on Waiheke and seeing that it can contribute both to Waihekeans and to the wider region and the world, perhaps, in some way.
Many years ago, there was a study done overseas, and I think they focused it a lot on some of the Italian towns because the towns are quite close. They have a village square, and you have alleyways, and people's balconies open up onto the alleys, and people talk to each other across from their different apartments and houses. And they wanted to know why some of these little communities were cohesive. And they found out that all the people were involved in something. Somebody belonged to the Stamp Collectors Club, others would be the Crocheting Club, or the Women's Institute, or the Artists, or the Life Saving Club, or the Dog Obedience Club. There were so many different groups of people, and everybody knew somebody from another group, and all these sort of lines of cohesiveness pulled them all together, that everybody was accepting of everyone. There was no judgment because they realized that there was goodness attached to everybody, and it brought the community together. It was the glue. And I see this in Waiheke Island, with transition towns and out of our own backyards, and the cinema over there, and there's so many different garden groups, and how many drama? There's a lot of people in drama.
Yeah, I think that's true. Before I moved to Waiheke, I lived in Hamilton, and yeah, we knew a fair number of people, but we tended to know people because of one thing, you know, that we met them because of, say, the theatre, or we met them because of the children in the school, and you never saw them again. You just met them for that purpose. So in your mind, that's who they were. Very shortly after we arrived to Waiheke, we find we were describing people to each other in terms of the three things that they did. They might be involved in the theatre, but they were also in the yacht club, and they also did something down at Stony Batter or something in the Historical Society. And so everybody had a much more rounded view of people very, very quickly. And I think this is interesting, not just in the sense in which it makes the community more cohesive. It makes each person much freer to be who they really want to be. Because when you know that people aren't going to judge you just on that 1 5-second contact that they've had with you through parent-teachers association or something, you can relax much more. You can be yourself. You don't have to go for artificial things to create your identity. You know, you don't worry so much about the visual appearance that you might be creating, because you know that people are going to judge you for what you are and what you do and how you react to other people. And so it's a much more, as a community, it's much more back to basic things and basic human-to-human contacts and so on. I'm not sure about the judgments. You get a lot of judgments. on Waiheke, but that's what people are. I mean, yeah, that's how you express yourself. That's how you become a character, is the judgments that you make. See, it's quite a robust environment, in I would say, in that sense, but it's an extremely colourful one, and it's extremely supportive if you're in need. I mean, that's the other wonderful side of it. And there are occasions when people are in need or they have a problem, and the community really does rally behind and support.
So with your biosphere reserve, of course, we've got things like climate change coming up, and we also wish to know, are you going to promote renewable energy far more?
Yeah, this is the interesting thing, really, that the biosphere reserve is very much based on the locality and the response to perhaps local issues to do with people getting in contact with an environment. But when you come to these bigger issues like global warming and so on, then, yes, obviously you want to make a contribution to those as well. And I've been looking at various islands around the world. I think there's 10 islands that are sort of similar to Waiheke in various ways. And they're all trying to get rid of transport that uses non-renewable energy. They're looking for renewable energy sources for transport within 10 years. And there's two islands that are both biosphere reserves, one in Spain and one in Japan, that are actually trying to go totally to renewable energy within 10 years. El Hierro in Spain happens to be quite windy, so they can do that with turbines. And when the turbines are going really well, they pump water uphill.
Yes.
And then when the wind drops, they let the water run down again. They use hydro.
Excellent.
And that scheme has got a lot of funding from the European Union. It started last year, and they reckon it'll be on stream within a few years. And they'll be totally self-sufficient. They have sufficient energy on the side to create hydrogen cells for all their vehicle fleets. The other one's Yakushima in Japan, where it's quite mountainous. It's in the south of Japan. It's quite mountainous, and it gets a huge amount of rainfall. I mean, really huge, like 2 meters in a month, you know, up in the top of the hills. And so they can harness that in terms of hydropower, and again, to use hydrogen cell. And Honda tests their hydrogen cell vehicles on the island, and have done for a number of years. And they want to extend that to shipping. That's what is of interest to us, because they think that they can. They actually did a survey to get rid of all non-renewable energy, right down to things like diesel oil and oil for things, and right down to cooking and air conditioners and everything. And they did this very interesting survey of how all of human needs that have energy components can be replaced in some way by some other system or some other renewable source. And that was a very interesting exercise, rather than just taking it at a high level and saying, yes, we're going to have wind power or something, and then, well, how do you all put oil in your car or something like that? So they did a completely comprehensive survey of their energy needs, and they're doing a lot of work in Yakushima. I could add to that, if you like, that that's what we've got to be thinking about in terms of Waiheke. I mean, yeah, we could become a biosphere reserve. Yes, we can carry on our regeneration and our weed control and pest control programs to get the forest to regenerate and bring back the natural wildlife, which is, you know, where we're at the moment in conservation on the island. And we can try and get people to do better things. But if we want to do one of these bigger things that address a contribution to these bigger global problems, then there's a number of things that we might consider. There was a big issue over the waste collection, which finally went to an overseas contractor last year. And pity, because there was a strong local workforce that used to manually sort the recycled things and get really good value from that recycled things. And now it's just gone into this big centralised system.
I know, it was a terrible thing. They were really organised on Waiheke,
yeah,
weren't they?
Yeah. And I mean, it was a big blow to the morale of the island that had spent so much time and effort trying to do this job well. And that counted for nothing. And so when the council has sat down and just made this decision on price, their view of what the price was going to be. But that spirit is still there on Waiheke. And so maybe it can come back to, with an aim to be kind of zero waste island, the first zero waste island or something like that. There is also obviously people who've been looking into renewable energy. Renewable energy has to fit the local situation. Wind, it is windy, but it's not windy regularly enough on Waiheke to actually make wind power a very good solution. We certainly don't have enough water to do hydro, but there are people who are looking at wave power, not so much wave power, but current power, energy generation that will go on fairly shallow seabed and pick up fast currents like you get around Waiheke.
So that's a channel.
Yeah, that's like a particular kind of technology that can generate energy from fast flowing shallow water, which would probably seem to be the best source of energy given our particular geological, geographical situation. Yeah.
And of course, to pull all this together, you need a research team. Are you doing a lot of it by yourself at the moment?
At the moment, but then people come forward and with their expertise and contribute to that, and we've had, you know, some very good sessions with that. But the bigger research thing, in terms of making an application to UNESCO, that would be one of our big problems, that people haven't been good at monitoring and researching and recording what they've done. You know, they've just done it and they've been proud to do it and they just go out and enjoy the bush at the end and that's fine. That's probably a little bit strong because when I'm beginning to really get into the project, I find that there have been a lot of monitoring projects that have gone on, but they're just kind of one copy on the desk somewhere on a shelf, and it's like 15 years old now and nobody knows it's there. So the first stage is going to be trying to find all that stuff and bring it together. But then I think beyond that, I would like to get the universities involved more because it's a wonderful site here, and an island's are fantastic for research, for universities. And here's this great site, and there's people that really want to do something, and they really need some monitoring and some research to be done, some research projects. And I think it's a great opportunity for all kinds of academics to do work themselves as academics or get their students to do monitoring projects on Waiheke. And I'm hoping, it's on my long list of things to do, but to get around to some of the universities and talk to some of the people and try and persuade them perhaps just to see outside their immediate academic life, to see here is a real life situation on their doorstep that really needs cooperation with universities, that's real, you know, it's really real to the people, you know.
In 1840, the Maori, the indigenous Maori and the British Crown had a treaty called Treaty of Waitangi. How does this treaty, which is still running at the moment, how does this relate to Waiheke's idea of the biosphere?
This is a really important issue, and the Marae Committee, Pūtahi Marae Committee on Waiheke Island, have always strongly supported the biosphere proposal, and as acknowledgement of that, about a month ago, or perhaps a bit less, we had a wānanga at the Marae, which was specifically about what I call walking on two legs, rather than trying to hop on one. Okay, this was a kind of, we wanted to open up the concepts and the language of the Biosphere Reserve to understand in a deep way how we were both seeing it as the same journey, although we might express it slightly differently to our different groups. And that was a very important day to us, and it was clear from the beginning that the Biosphere Project is about the land and it's about the people and the way that they work together and they respect each other, and they are almost part of the same thing, that you don't make big distinctions between the land and the people. And I think just from that very fundamental understanding of how we both see the future together in the same concepts, we went through the whole day talking about these issues.
Because we are all an extension of the web of life, and it is imperative that we understand our relationship with nature. So important. Because the Maori also have this wonderful relationship of honouring nature. If in the past they cut down a tree, they'd have a karakia, a prayer, and they would invoke Tāne, or they'd thank Tāne before they cut the tree down. Or if they went fishing, they would thank Tangiroa, the god of the seas. And it's just to realise that we're just not mindless automatons going out there consuming and taking, that we actually have a communication, a sacred understanding that life is precious.
Yeah, that's right, that it isn't just an endless resource that you can just take and throw away and it doesn't matter. But there's, even within that kind of spiritual interpretation, there was often very practical ideas, because the Maori on Waiheke, before Pākehā came, had quite extensive agriculture on the island, but it tended to move around every few years, and so the areas would regenerate, and so the overall impact on the island was pretty negligible in long-term, in historical terms. Then, of course, Pākehā arrived, and they wanted the timber for ship spars and whatever, and the whole island got logged in a very short period of time. And at the end of that, all it was good for was pastoral farming. It wasn't even good for that, really, but that's all they did. And it supported four pastoral farms. A couple of hundred people was all it would support, whereas previously it had supported thousands of Maori working in a much more sensitive way. Now the task is to try and restore that and restore those kind of processes back. So there's recently, I mean, the Marae have always been growing kumara on the island, and it's one of the traditions that they do. But now there's a Pākehā group that's trying to reintroduce, you know, growing your own food on the island, to try and see whether we can make the island more productive in terms of growing our own food, because it's not terribly good soil. I mean, it's been logged and it's been exposed for too long.
And the runoff and the erosion has just taken all away. Is that out of our backyards?
There's a group called Community Supported Agriculture Group, which is actually a farm. It employs a farmer to go and grow food, but it's like in a cooperative way. Yeah.
I see.
It's trying to get some serious agricultural production going on the island that's environmentally sensitive and improves the quality of food that people eat and be more self-sufficient, more empowered, I guess.
I'm speaking with Colin Bearden on the concept of Waiheke Island becoming a biosphere reserve. Colin, what sort of area would this Waiheke biosphere reserve cover? Because you could bring in a number of other islands solely because they're very sensitive to man's encroachment.
Unfortunately, that's a political question, but I'll get into it. At the moment, we've said that we're putting Waiheke Island itself forward, and that's it. And I think part of the reason for that is that we're only going to speak for where we come from. And if other people wish to join us, that would be wonderful. But that's their decision. I mean, I know that on Great Barrier, for example, they're, for their own reasons, they're probably not interested. I'm not going to speak for Great Barrier Island. It's up to them to speak for themselves. If people felt, the people who are responsible for the Gulf felt that they wanted the waters of the Gulf included, that would be wonderful. But again, that's not something that we can speak for, but it'd certainly be something we welcome. In terms of the islands immediately around Waiheke, thinking of Rangitoto, Motuihe, Motutapu, and a few others around there, Ponui and so on, that's a little bit more difficult because they will actually come under the new Waiheke local board under the reorganisation. And there are ecological links between those, because in regenerating some of those islands, the Department of Conservation often get their native plants and trees sourced from Waiheke seed. So Waiheke is becoming a generator of native plants for the other islands. So there would be some ecological and scientific case for saying that they are part of the same project, in a sense. But again, you can only do it if people want to do it, and these are largely uninhabited islands, so they tend to fall under fairly bureaucratic organisations, and that's when the politics gets going. So I'd rather achieve something on Waiheke, and then we can expand it, than start off with too many arguments and discussions about what the boundaries are.
So Waiheke can sustain itself on its own water through rainwater coming in. What's the deal with sewage?
Well, at the moment, yeah, I mean, everything's done on the septic tank system, and there's distribution on the island for that. So we are totally self-sufficient, if you like, on that. So, I mean, there are issues around that. Certainly say that the council are planning a new combined library service centre in Onorara, and it's still unsure about the effect that that's going to have on the sewage fields that will be dealing with that, because it's quite a large public space. So we have to think of those issues very carefully when resource management comes through. But, I mean, at the moment, yes, we have our own systems. The thing about the island, I was at an election meeting yesterday, and somebody raised the question of reticulation, that if reticulation comes in like it is in the city, what will happen on Waiheke is that the density of housing can increase hugely because there's a relationship. If you're using your own septic system, there's a limit to what the land can produce, and it's roughly, in urban areas, it's a house to every 1,000 or so square metres, say 1,000 square metres would be a kind of typical control. If you've got reticulation, of course, you can, that is no longer a limit. It's the limit of your sewage system. And so the possibility of high-rise buildings, the possibility of, you know, large resorts comes in. So all the candidates, and there's 17 candidates standing for the local board, were asked, would you be in favour of reticulation? And not one's in favour of it, not one.
Well, that's very good for the Waihekians who want to continue the way they're living. And what about ecotourism? Because ecotourism supposedly is an answer to allowing people to connect with the land, to connect with their breath, to be able to see the beauty in everything. How do you feel ecotourism may affect Waiheke?
That's a complicated issue, because ecotourism can be very good for solving problems that small communities have, like Waiheke have. If their problem is that they lack an economic base to provide decent housing or jobs for young people and meaningful jobs for young people, then ecotourism can be very good. And I could quote an example in France of an island that was, if nothing had been done, it would have become uninhabited within 10 years. And they embraced ecotourism, and they're now a stable and thriving community, and they haven't had to abandon their home. So that's obviously a good thing. They could do that. The problem was, after 20 years, it became so popular it started to swamp them, because ecotourism can also be mass tourism. And mass tourism creates problems, particularly if it's based on ecology and people don't always know what we're walking on and treading on when they walk around sensitive sites and so on. So there are other issues, things. But what I've learned from the Biosphere Reserve is that all of these things, and they're not like one solution for everything. You have to understand what your current problem is, and then you find a solution that addresses that problem. If you go too mad with it, it creates other problems, and then you have to have other things to solve those problems. And I guess that's life, isn't it? I mean, life's like that, you know. You never get a solution that fixes it for all time. But there are plenty of solutions out there that people have tried, and ecotourism is certainly good. And the other important thing, I think, to realise with ecotourism is that the island has to have its own economy. There's been a sense that Waiheke joined Auckland City in 1989. It used to be, had its own county council. And there's been a sense of that Auckland has almost made us indebted. It's almost underdeveloped us so that we're dependent economically on the city. And Waihekeans don't feel that. They don't feel they're economically dependent. But you talk to the city council people, and they will always be telling you how much Waiheke costs them. Now, I don't accept their arguments, but there's a kind of deeper philosophical point here, is that if you haven't got your own economy sorted out, if you're not earning away, in a sense, and making your living so that you can get the things you need, you're not really politically independent. You're not independent as people. And so for all the problems that ecotourism may bring, and some people have some doubts about it, at the end of the day, we have to make a living, and that's the way we should be doing it.
So the main benefits for the Biosphere Reserve then, and for Waiheke, can you just give the main benefits just quickly?
For Waiheke,
yes,
itself? I think, well, first of all, it's preserving the essentially good things that are on Waiheke for future generations, and future generations and way into the future is setting that up. I think it makes us more, it empowers local people, it empowers the local community, and makes it stronger and more resilient, which I think is very important in present times. But it also, it makes it an open and friendly place where people can come and learn and share and learn and take things away. So it's actually, it's not shutting us off. It's making a very important contribution to everybody's life, in the, not just in the region, in anybody who comes to visit, really. So I think those are the three most important.
And so what would be the benefits for Auckland?
Well, I think it would be fantastic for Auckland to have a shining example of sustainable development just on the doorstep there, that it could be really proud of because it's recognised internationally through the United Nations. I mean, that would be a real feather in Auckland's cap, and I don't see why it would find anything but pure benefit from that.
And, of course, from the New Zealand standpoint, it's virtually the same.
Exactly the same, and gives us credibility in the United Nations and everything, yeah.
Colin, we had a 7.1 earthquake down in Christchurch just recently, and the people came together in resilience very well. And a lot of people learned from it that we have to be ready for anything to happen in the way of coming together as a community and also having food and first aid, etc. How do you see Waiheke in this context?
It came up in a different way at a meeting last week, where people were talking about climate change, that, you know, if it really does get bad, like it seems to, we're going to be getting, well, we're already getting, but we're going to be getting more extreme weather situations where possibly as an island we're going to be suffer quite heavily from some of these. So the question came to me through that meeting was, how is this going to help almost that kind of disaster response, which is similar to what they're facing in Christchurch there? And of course there's a lot of practical things that you can say about that, of how we're going to be ready, and the island is very good. It's got the great volunteer fire service, and it's got boaters, and it's got all kinds of people that are very practical that can come through and help. But behind all of that, there is this sort of deeper philosophical ability of people to feel empowered, to feel that the situation is challenging them and they're going to rise to this challenge, and they're going to do it together as a community in a kind of, without, you know, a lot of pre-organisation, but they're just going to respond because that's the way they treat life. And I think once you get involved with cities, you tend to lose that. Go to around the suburbs of Auckland and you think, if there was a disaster in, you know, Mount Albert or somewhere, would the community really come together in that way? I'm sure they would, but it would be very different on Waiheke, because people would instinctively respond. And I think that the Biosphere Reserve is an expression of that, and it strengthens that sense of personal empowerment and not looking to others all the time to solve your problems, but to make the move yourself, but with others. And that, I think, probably is what you admire most of the people of Christchurch at the moment. It's all the practical things as well, but it's the spirit of, yeah, we are going to get through this, and we're going to put up with all these aftershocks and whatever, and we're still going to carry on our lives, you know.
We learn the value of cooperation, don't we?
We do, yeah, yeah. And not just cooperation, I'm sort of loath to use the word leadership, because it makes it sound like one person is standing up, but like you become a community of leaders. Everybody's a leader in a sense. And that's a wonderful feeling when that happens.
Imperative. I do agree. We all have to be able to resource ourselves and stand up and be counted when it's required.
Yeah, and to know that we contribute to something. You know, we are contributing and other people are contributing, and the sum total is that we're going to get out of this situation.
Now, I was told that Waiheke had the highest percentage of volunteer groups possibly in the world for the head of population. Can you explain a little about this? Because this is what community spirit's all about.
Absolutely. There's a booklet on community groups in Waiheke that lists the contacts. And it was produced about 4 years ago. There's 198 organisations, and out of a population of 8,000 people, 198 organisations. And there's some that aren't in that book that I know of, so I would probably put the figure at the moment around 250 probably organisations on the island, working in all kinds of things, from, you know, the health sector, through the arts sector, through environment sectors and boating and teaching kids to sail and life saving and civil defence, everything you can think of. And that's great. I mean, I personally also chair the theatre, Artworks Communities Theatre, and even to have a fully functioning theatre with a population of 8,000 is quite unusual these days, you know, because we, well, probably 99% of our tickets are sold to Waihikians, not many other people come. So that's quite remarkable that we can run and put on things most weeks, there's something on there. But when I look around the island, there's probably 15 other venues where live performance goes on. So any weekend night, you've probably got 6 or 7 venues where something live is happening on the island, and it's great. And all the time, there's young people coming forward, and they're given the opportunity. Just last week, a couple of weeks ago, we had a concert, and a young group that just started, it was their first concert, you know, at 15, standing up and playing a couple of numbers in a supportive environment. And you think, yeah, this is what it is. It's not about sitting back and going and choosing the latest thing for your iPod. It's about standing up and singing this song yourself.
It'd be very interesting to see how many people in Waiheke turn their televisions off every night.
It's interesting how many haven't got televisions.
Yes, it's a huge distraction, and really, it's not helping the community at all. It's just fragmenting us and making us more dysfunctional.
Unlike radio.
You like radio. Good on you. Colin, what I like about Waiheke is that you have to travel by boat in most cases, you know, fast catamarans. And when you get on the boat, you're all jammed together. You're meeting people all the time from this island. And I've met some fantastic people just going backwards and forwards, people who are quite prominent and very, very dynamic. Can you explain a little bit about this?
Yeah, I have this theory that the ferries are a really wonderful social institution, because no matter who you are, Waiheke, no matter how rich you are, how poor you are, whatever, the only way really of getting off the island and in any kind of organised way is by the ferry. So everybody uses the ferry. 8,000 people, they all use the ferry. Now, the rest of Auckland, I can't think of anything that compares with that. There's nothing that all Aucklanders have to do. And not only do you have to use it, but you have to sit down on chairs opposite other people across the table, and you start talking. So it's one of those Waiheke experiences. If you live on the island, you come over to Auckland for the day because you've got some business to do, and you notice that people don't say hello to each other, which is a bit strange. You walk up and down the street not looking at other people, and it all seems a very quiet and society, and then you step back on the ferry and it's just noise, you know. It's like school was when the teacher went out the room. It's really people excited and talking and chatting, and then you just think, yeah, I'm back on Waiheke now. This is community. And yeah, we've lost that. I mean, you know, people used to have village greens or whatever they would sit around in, or there's marais that people would hang around and just talk about stuff. And that's the community, and that's the community politics in a way. It's not high-powered outside stuff. It's just people talking about their experiences and sharing them. And so the ferry is very important. I mean, if there was ever a bridge to Waiheke, that would be the end of the community.
Waiheke in summer is magnificent. And you can go for walks, and you can walk up huge bluffs and out on the hills, and you view this magnificent panorama of blue water around you, and you can look back over on the mainland and down towards the Coromandel. I mean, it is magnificent, isn't it?
It is spectacular in winter as well. I mean, there's a clear sight. I mean, you can see for miles up the coast.
Yes.
And the clear winter days, it's a beautiful place. But I mean, there's lots of beautiful places around New Zealand, aren't there? Waiheke, if I could just take on another turn. In terms of, I mentioned before that Waiheke was cleared and deforested about 150 years ago.
They did a darn good job of that, unfortunately.
They certainly did. Yeah. It was all ship spars and then timber banks, for housing in Auckland and whatever. Almost totally cleared. And a few people have gone out and they've discovered an area down the east end of the island that was logged, but it wasn't logged as badly as the other. There's a few gullies down there that still have semblance of the original vegetation, and even some unique plants that only grow on Waiheke, even.
Go on.
Yeah, just one or two there. And over the years, they've brought them back, and they grow Waiheke native seed trees and plants. And then there's been reserves, and there was a Whakanefa National Park and various forest and bird reserves and so on, to try and bring back some of the original vegetation. And then the next stage is to corridors, to join them up, because the first stage of trying to restore or regenerate an environment is you've got to get the plant life back. That's where you start. So you get the plant life back, and then the bird life will come and the animal life will follow, but it won't come unless the trees are there, the forests are there. So the program has always been to try and create these corridors, and then the bird life will follow. And so earlier this year, Mike Lee and the others released the bellbirds back onto Waiheke.
Oh, excellent.
A great symbol of...
Wow.
Now, to do that, you have to be able to control the rat population. And so the stage really we're at in terms of trying to regenerate Waiheke, or where the people involved in these projects are at in regenerating Waiheke, is to really try and control the weeds and the pests that would stop the area just naturally regenerating. Because, you know, you put a lot of work into regeneration, but the end idea is you do nothing, because it's a natural environment that you've recreated. So you don't want an environment where you have to keep intervening. You want one that's restored to what it should be. So eventually you should be withdrawing your things. But what's happening is that is happening to some extent, and people are moving out to say, well, now we need to control the weeds and the pests, particularly in the areas around the reserves. And a lot of those are private landowners, and a lot of them cooperate very, very well, because they love the land. That's why they're there as well. And so we're looking at ways in which that can be supported now, and that gradually that expands. Now, that's very important for the UNESCO Biosphere Reserve, because from an ecological point of view, they want us to describe our area in terms of what they call a key core area, which is crucial purely for biodiversity. Nothing to do with people at all, mankind. It's the natural environment has to be restored in its natural form without human beings. So that's the first area that they're interested in. Then there's what they call a buffer area, which is where people live, but usually fairly low density, and they support that core area. And then there's a bigger area, which could be an urban area, where people try to live more sustainable lives, environmentally sustainable lives. And they specifically ask that we describe those three areas. Now, that's why this particular biosphere reserve proposal particularly attracted me, because it's not an artificial thing. It actually describes what we're doing on Waiheke, what's been going on for the past 25, 30 years in terms of regeneration.
Excellent. And you've got all this bird life. I know, kereroos, tuis, bellbirds. It's magnificent.
Yeah.
And the thing that I like most is if on a Friday night, getting on that ferry, having a drink, as you see Auckland recede in the distance and Waiheke loom up in front of you. Colin, thank you so much for coming and sharing. I wish you well. Yeah. And you're also involved in the elections here.
I am. I'm standing for the new local board on Waiheke, yeah, on this platform, really, saying, you know, if you want to do this, get behind me and we'll do it.
Website?
The website for the Biosphere Reserve is, all one word, Waiheke BR, BR for Biosphere Reserve, so that's waihekebr.info, and my personal website is colinbearden.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Colin.
Thank you so much.
That was Colin Bearden talking about the concept of having Waiheke Island become a biosphere reserve where we, all the community and the total environment, is safeguarded for future generations and becomes a crown jewel in what New Zealand has to offer in living closely aligned with the land and all biota. This program can be listened on the web at 9:05 Thursday, streamed from the Planet FM studios at planetaudio.org.nz, search Green, and iPod and streaming can be obtained 6 hours after broadcasting on greenplanetfm.com, holisticliving.co.nz, and itunes.com, and search Health. Thank you for tuning into greenplanetfm.com. I trust you enjoy this program coming as a voice from the Southern Hemisphere in Auckland, Aotearoa, New Zealand. As New Zealand is perceived as the closest major country to the international dateline, we here see tomorrow first, being 12 hours ahead of Britain and 17 hours in advance of the USA. We are already experiencing Tomorrowland now. By being in the future, the aim of this program is to sow seeds of possibility and positivity and anchor the ideal that we humans are imbued with potential, that we are embedded within nature from where we spring, and that we have a capacity to achieve profound understandings and capabilities once we break free of unknowingness. At heart, we all want crystal clear, fresh air to breathe, plus vital, pure, chemical-free water to drink, and nutrient-rich organic food to eat. If we can attain these three necessities at a local level, can we expand this archetype to encircle the globe so that all peoples enjoy this prime example of healthy sustenance? Inclusive of above, we require warm, cohesive family and community relationships at a local, regional, and national level. So can we enlarge on this to see ourselves as an extension of the global family living on this magnificent superorganism we call Earth? Yes, it's a big ask, yet let us set this intent. Remember on the moon, Pandora, in the recent movie hit Avatar. The moon orbiting a giant gaseous planet was seen as sentient, and that the Na'vi, the indigenous inhabitants who lived there, saw all life as sacred, and that they borrowed their bodies from their feminine sustainer, and so revered the moon and its biota, especially the trees, which they venerated as an elemental extension of themselves and their world. With our planet now facing critical ecological, economic and societal dilemmas and a growing cause for concern, many people now are questioning why we have come into being and why are we here and why now. And with recent breakthroughs in science, especially led by Bruce Lipton and his new book Spontaneous Evolution, that at the core of our being, our bodies are constructs of advanced bacteria assembled as 50 trillion plus cells who want to live forever, and that we are beings of unlimited possibilities, and at a subatomic level, that is what we really are. Energy bundles of exponential potential, so clearly expressed by Lynn McTaggart in her book, The Field, that our body is an energy field in a greater universal energy field. So, the challenge for us all is if we can unfold and integrate this newly acquired knowingness and make a jump in our belief systems, a transformation of who we are as a person and a species can be realized. All we need to do is grok this, to grow into the light of our own true selves. Of course, you may say, but we have to survive and work, make money, pay bills, mortgages or rent, take care of the kids, have time off. That life is for so many very stressful. And I say, yes, this is true, and for me too. Yet life is becoming uneasy for many, especially in the developing world. Yet if we do not make the effort to grow and change, what will become of our world, be it locally or globally? With change being the only constant in this world, the challenge for us as a planet in transition to a higher consciousness is that we do the work with our family, friends and community. This means that every conversation we have, every email we send, every telephone call we make and meetings we attend, that we communicate warmly, astutely and clearly. At the same time, look deeply within ourselves and reconnect with the quintessential nature of who we really are and make this life the most beneficial, fulfilling and significant one possible. One where the sacred and our higher self coalesce into a world of higher aspiration and opportunity for all. This is why we in Nuclear Free New Zealand wish to offer up a point of difference that is a country that stands out alone in the Southwest Pacific, in the Southern Hemisphere, so close to Antarctica and the South Pole. We feel drawn to being a good planetary citizen and a moral force for good, to work towards a planet of benevolence and one mind, where at heart we retain our individuality, yet collectively work for the betterment of the whole. This is one of the many aims of the GreenPlanetFM.com program, where in the spirit of goodwill, we work to restore our world to a planet of peace for our children's children's children. This is Tim Lynch, wishing you a successful week, saying kia ora and haere rā.